Newt Gingrich may have complained about the way he feels toxic language has unfairly tainted him recently, but in Ben Marcus's new novel, language is capable of literally destroying a person. It's a dystopian tale where children's speech becomes poisonous and it examines the importance of language in our society. The Flame Alphabet is Mr. Marcus's third novel. It's published by Knopp, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hi.
Hi.
And in the book, you say that Plutarch, Cicero, and Ovid warned their readers about the danger inherent in glimpsing their words. Is that something they actually did?
They did not.
Oh, okay.
But there was a point in the book when the narrator, Sam, is looking into precedent and warnings, and it seemed to have more credence and authority if it came from Plutarch. I sort of liked Plutarch for that quote.
As a writer and teacher, how much do you think about the effect language has on those who read or hear it?
A lot. The book started with the idea that language is so potent that it changes our feelings. It changes what we think. It seems to be almost like a drug. So I wondered about what would happen if it was magnified. Could we take too much of it? That was the imaginative conceit that began the book.
And children wield words like weapons in this book, and they are the only group immune from a speech fever that ravages the adult population. Now, kids often say terrible things to adults.
Yeah, it's true. But at most, it might be annoying. It doesn't exactly make us physically sick. I think it was an exaggeration of something existing and then looking for a story out of that.
Well, they also become more sadistic once they realize their power over adults. In this family here, Samuel, the father, describes his daughter Esther as someone having unchecked hatred even before her language causes the adults any physical harm. So, and children can really hurt their parents with their words.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I hate you when a kid is having a tantrum.
Yeah.
Sometimes it can be very painful to hear.
And at the same time, it's safe to say that to one's parent. After I had children, I became more aware of what it is to be a son. It made me think about all the not so great things I'd done and said to my own parents. Suddenly, the way I had mildly taken them for granted became very clear to me. I think we need to see our parents as protectors, and in that sense, they become slightly less human, maybe.
This is about a family, a mother and father, Claire and Samuel, and their daughter, Esther, and the story seems to be as much about their struggle as it is about the country's struggle with the plague. Did you think of it as a story of a family?
I really did. It's a story to me about what parents do if the creature they love the most is also causing them harm. In other words, how strong is the paternal bond? How close will a father stay to danger? Or will he simply try to get away? Which is stronger, loyalty or one's own self-protection? That's, I think, the drama I explored in the book.
What kinds of physical symptoms do the sick adults experience?
Well, there's something called crushing. It seems to just be a tightness in the chest. There's something called facial smallness. People get slightly smaller faces.
They're withering away?
Yeah, they're wasting away. They're tired. There's a lethargy. They take themselves to doctors, and no one can quite figure out what happens. So they try to troubleshoot on their own at home. That's sort of how the novel takes off in its second part. The narrator is trying to invent a new language that might not make people sick.
Mm-hmm. As a father, were you troubled by anything you found yourself writing here?
Yeah, all of it. I think in some sense I'm attracted to writing things that worry and scare me a little bit. On the other hand, I adore my kids, and in some sense it's a testing out of a kind of nightmare that I hope never happens to me.
Some years back, you wrote an essay for Harper's Magazine that defended the importance of experimental fiction. Would you call this experimental fiction or something more like speculative fiction, the preferred description of Margaret Atwood?
Yeah, I feel like I get to invoke a pass on the actual label. I enjoy the word novel, and it seems to cover lots of different kinds of things. At the same time, I understand why people would like to categorize it more specifically. I think I love what's possible in language, but I also love the traditions of storytelling. To me, there are both things here in this book.
Although this is something of a departure for you because it is more straight narrative than your previous work.
I think it is. It has one narrator telling his story, so it's in his voice, and I think he has a natural-sounding voice.
A small subset of Judaism is important to this story, and I'm assuming, based on the fact that it is a bit wild, that you invented it.
You haven't heard of the forest Jews.
No.
It is invented. The narrator, Sam, and his wife worship in the forest in a two-person synagogue, and I did a lot of research in Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism as well as Christian mysticism. It was important to me to have them practice a religion that in some sense is anti-verbal. They can't really discuss it or share it. And I think mysticism is worried or resistant to language. It doesn't want to explain a deep spiritual reaction.
They go to a small hut in the woods where sermons are piped in through a listening device that comes from a hole in the ground.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's kind of mystical as well. Why use Judaism as a base? Why not just invent a new religion altogether?
Well, again, like the use of Plutarch, if I had made up a name for this religion, I think it would have looked too obviously made up and perhaps easy to dismiss. Judaism, to me, accommodated this invention. I think its offshoots, its intellectual tradition, its subversive cultural tradition, to me, allowed this invention to take place.
The flame the alphabet that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Is that a real concept
in
Judaism?
Yes, it is. It's from Kabbalah. The flame alphabet is the word of God written in fire.
Mm-hmm. There's a long history of stories that have linked language and religion, like the Tower of Babel, for example.
Sure.
Do you have that in mind?
Yeah, and the Tower of Babel is a small subject in the book, a subject of dispute. And there's a kind of nefarious character who argues that sometimes things like the Tower of Babel, that incident, are important to actually sever people's ability to communicate.
So Kabbalah was something in the back of your mind. What about all of those prominent authors who've written about Judaism in America? Saul Bellow, Bernard Malamud, Philip Roth, I.B. Singer.
All of them. I grew up reading that work and deeply value it. I just never knew, and I grew up Jewish, but I never knew how I was going to write about it. I think that the ground had been staked out so beautifully and consummately by Bellow, Roth, Malamud, that to me, and until I could find some way that I felt was my own, I wasn't ready to do it.
My guest is Ben Marcus, whose latest novel is The Flame Alphabet. There's a mysterious character in the story called Lubov, who also writes about language and its destructive capabilities.
Yeah, and he comes sort of sniffing around after the narrator's religious practice. He's looking for a cure to the speech fever, and he believes that it's being withheld from him in this secretive religion. So he's going to try to do anything to hack into the rabbi's sermons that are pumping in through this forest synagogue.
Although he does, he's a bit paranoid.
Yeah, he seems willing to try anything.
There are many allusions to smoke in the book. It's used to treat the sick adults. And Samuel is able to capture smoke in a small wax bubble, which he gives to his daughter as a gift. And, of course, it's a product of fire. What does it represent to the story? Are you saying language sometimes is illusory as smoke?
That sounds nice. I hadn't thought of that and hadn't even really been aware that I was writing a lot about smoke. But that sounds like a good interpretation to me.
You can use it from now on if you want to.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
The healing smoke is just the first step of Samuel's experiments. And he comes up with a whole bunch of different ones.
Yeah, the doctors can't help. So he starts to conduct medical experiments at home, knowing very little, making the problem worse. But he's trying to take action and not be passive. Later, he starts to try to invent languages. He goes all the way back to cuneiform, to hieroglyphs, to try to see if those languages might work again. And he, of course, doesn't succeed.
Well, part of the problem also is that since people can't speak anymore, it's harder to communicate.
Yeah, he's in a
sense. And you're writing a novel with where dialogue is at a premium.
Yeah, I know. I got stuck about halfway through and realized none of my characters could talk to each other anymore. And I needed to figure that out.
you'd cause a real problem for yourself.
Yeah.
Have you ever discovered any real examples of people being physically harmed by language or communication?
That's a good question.
Did you research, do any research for this other than inventing statements by Plutarch?
I did a lot of research, but I don't seem capable of using it in a one-to-one way. I did a lot of religious research. I did a lot of research into acoustical weapons and that the military uses, sound guns and things like that. And I also research a lot with people who have experimented on themselves in history, people who have tested medicines, and that interested me. But as to a genuinely potent language, you know, other than the Tower of Babel, which isn't exactly a potent language so much as a divided one, I don't know of an example.
There is a new film that deals with people losing their senses one by one, some strange disease that affects the world. And it is one of the saddest movies I've seen. It hasn't opened yet, but...
What's it called?
And now I'm trying to remember. Something Sense.
That sounds very sad.
It is very sad. But we take our senses for granted. And
sure.
Even if we lose one of them, we lose sight or we can't hear or something, we can compensate with other things. But it's really hard if you can't speak.
And I think it's always been the subject of fascination. What are we without language? You know, when someone crawls out of the woods raised by wolves who can't communicate, we're fascinated by what their inner life might be. And I think as the narrator and his family and everyone loses their language, I wanted to explore what happens when our speech goes silent.
The film is called Perfect Sense, I think.
Okay. I'll check it out.
Did you know from the start that you're going to just have one narrator here?
I did. I hoped, but, you know,
then the problem is finding the voice.
Yeah, there was that. I had some false starts, the usual stuff, threw some stuff away, lashed myself with a whip.
But, do you go through a lot of drafts?
I guess I did. But I wrote the book in about 2 years, so it wasn't so bad. But I have to throw some stuff away.
I understand there's an illustrated trailer for your book online.
Yeah, I met a terrific artist named Erin Cosgrove. She does animated work as well as painting and sculpture. And just by luck, she agreed to make a little trailer that I found very exciting. It's chilly and disturbing, and I thought it really captured the book well.
Ben Marcus is the author of 3 books. Actually, this is your 4th?
Yeah, well...
How many of there been one, short stories? Is something that's...
The first was a book of stories. There was a novel, and then I did a collaboration with an artist that's sometimes called a book, but it's a small chapbook. And so this was...
This is really your second novel.
Yeah, second novel, third book.
The Flame Alphabet, it is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.